AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. And by propane. Propane is the energy for everyone, especially farmers. Environmentally friendly propane can fuel most anything on the farm. See how at propane.com. The Japanese Prime Minister was in the U.S. this week. Plenty of opportunities for state dinners and a joint session of Congress. We will get a report from someone that was in D.C. for the festivities. And bird flu, farm bill, inflation. We have a lot to cover in this week's Free for All.
Live from an historic date in history via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning, former Iowa Pork Producers Association President Trish Cook will join us from Washington, D.C. Then it's this week's Friday Free-for-All with Jim Wiesmeyer and Tyne Morgan of U.S. Farm Report. After the news with the aforementioned Tyne Morgan, we'll hear from Jennifer Scheich of Farm Journal's Pork. I am producer Big Apple Joe Stackler, and here is the host of AgriTalk, Chip Flory.
All right, Big Apple Joe. Thank you, buddy. Appreciate that. Yeah, a lot going on this week, and we've got a lot to get through, and including that joint session of Congress and the address from the Japanese Prime Minister. Trish Cook was there. We're going to find out exactly what her impressions are of the events that took place in D.C., along with get an update from some of the legislative work that is being done on behalf of pork producers out there in D.C. So looking forward to catching up with Trish Cook. Then we've got Wiesmeyer standing by. He's ready to go, chomping at the bit. And Tyne Morgan, U.S. Farm Report host, is standing by with the news. How you doing, Tyne?
Listen, it is an honor for you to allow me to join the free-for-all. I don't know who signed off on this, Chip, but I appreciate it.
Well, you know, when you get the letter, you get the note from management up the ladder, you just kind of have to go with it, I guess, Tyne, you know, and here's where
letters.
We find ourselves. We'll just have to make the best of it. Okay.
I don't get any letters from management, so I'm not sure these letters you speak of. No, Chip, this morning though, before the girls were leaving for school and they said, Mom, I hope you have a great day. And I said, I am. I'm actually on the radio today. They think that's a bigger deal than being on TV, just so you know. And they were like, I am telling all my friends at school.
Nice. Nice. Those girls have got their priorities right.
They do.
All right. Well, Tyne, I'm glad that you're going to be sticking around. We've got Trish coming up in the next segment, but you'll be back at the bottom of the hour after we go through some news items. What have you got?
Well, we have a lot. So South Dakota, Chip, is the latest state to confirm highly pathogenic avian influenza in a dairy herd. It represents the 22nd case. Or I'm sorry. Well, that represented the 22nd case and the 8th state with an outbreak of the virus. Yeah. But here's the deal, Chip. More cases confirmed this morning in Texas and New Mexico. So with those cases, the total number of HPAI in livestock now is up to 24 cases total. And I know we'll talk about it in the free-for-all, but that number likely to grow. Chip, so far, the Federal Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service has stated that it will not issue federal quarantine orders. It's also not recommending any state regulatory quarantines or official hold orders on cattle. Instead, APHIS strongly advises minimizing cattle movement as much as possible and is discouraging the transportation of sick or exposed animals. A total of 17 states are now enforcing bans on the entry of dairy cattle from states where bovine influenza A virus cases have been confirmed. And Chip, I know we're going to talk about this name later because some in the industry are calling it bovine influenza A virus, B-I-A-V, but APHIS still calling it a strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza. No matter what you call it, it's spreading.
Well, yeah. And part of the issue here is, and it may seem inconsequential, but it's not. The industry needs to settle on what they're going to call this to avoid confusion on it going forward. The other thing is the 17 states enforcing bans on entry of cattle raises questions in my mind about how quickly the virus might be spreading from cow to cow, or if that is happening. And just a lot of uncertainty surrounding this one. We'll talk about it more later. Thanks.
Yeah, we definitely will. All right. In other news, USDA this morning announcing the sale of 124,000 metric tons of U.S. soybeans for delivery to unknown destinations in the current marketing year. This was the third soybean sale to unknown destinations announced this week. China imported 5.54 million metric tons of soybeans in March, down nearly 20% from March of last year and the lowest tally for the month in 4 years. That put China's first quarter 2024 soybean imports at 20.8 million metric tons, down 10.8% from a year ago and a four-year low in Chinese soybean imports. Also, China's trade surplus in March shrank to $58.55 billion. Exports declined 7.5% from a year ago and imports fell 1.9%. It was the first decline in China's trade balance since November of last year. Highlights from yesterday's supply and demand updates from USDA, that April report. Well, corn carryover for 2023-2024 was cut 50 million bushels from March on higher estimates of feed and residual and food, seed and industrial use. All of the increase in FSI use went to corn for ethanol ahead of the report. Trade expected a 70 million bushel cut to carryover. Soybean carryover at 340 million bushels is up 25 million bushels from March. A 20 million bushel cut to estimated exports highlighted the report. And wheat carryover at 698 million bushels is up 25 million bushels from March. A drop in feed and residual use was the highlight of that. But there's a lot of question marks after that report, Chip, about why we did not see more adjustments to the South American crop.
Absolutely. And I think the private industry time, quite frankly, is wondering what in the heck is USDA waiting for to make some yield adjustments. I think, as we've talked about in the past, it's USDA taking a look at its satellite data and deciding there's more area planted to corn and soybeans in Brazil than anybody has accounted for in the market. So something that we're going to watch going forward. Tyne, thanks. Stick around. We'll talk to you more at the bottom of the hour.
Thanks, Chip.
You bet. Let's bring in Jennifer Shike, editor at Farm Journal's Pork. Good morning, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Really good. This story that you've got on www.porkbusiness.com about Tony's and the snout-to-tail selling strategy, this is such a cool story. Tell us about it.
Well, I had such a neat opportunity to go visit a couple of Tony's stores and actually get to go to their corporate office and visit with Scott Hackbarth, who's their director of meat and seafood. And it was such an eye-opening experience because I've heard about Tony's and the great work that they do because they have a really large multicultural consumer base who's really interested in literally eating every part of the hog. I mean, they use everything. So I'm walking around and I'm seeing blood and lard and, you know, snouts and tails and literally everything in between. But their assortment of chops and roasts and hams was incredible. It's like a, you know, pork on steroids. That's not a term. But anyway, I mean, there's like pork everywhere. And what you would see in a typical grocery store that has a good meat counter just pales in comparison to how much they are selling there because that's what their consumers are demanding. But what's really cool, so their strategies around what to price when based on what time of the month it is for the consumer and where their pocketbook is. And just so mind-boggling at what they're doing and makes me think, like, what, how can we up it a little more in other stores? Because the demand is there. I mean, they were selling pork like crazy while I visited.
Yeah.
So
another cool thing is that it was intended to target the Hispanic consumers, but by doing that, they've attracted a whole new line of consumers that is not necessarily Hispanic, correct?
They're really reaching a lot of different cultures, and they're also opening everybody's minds up to new ways to cook and prepare pork.
It's fantastic. It's a great story. www.porkbusiness.com. You got to check that one out. Jennifer Shike, editor, Farm Journal's Pork. We got Trish Cook, past president, IPPC, up next.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
From powering irrigation engines to warming buildings, propane has always been a part of American farm life. Now, you can be a part of propane's future and save money at the same time. The Propane Farm Incentive Program is a research initiative that provides farmers up to $5,000 towards the purchase of new propane-powered equipment. In exchange, participants share performance data to make tomorrow's ag operations more cost-effective, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly with propane. Getting started is simple. Visit propane.com/farm incentive to see if you're eligible.
In the morning, you're coffeeed up and you're thinking. In the afternoon, you've calmed down, but you're still thinking. We're here all day. AgriTalk.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip. Glad you're here. It's Friday. We are going to put off the start of the free-for-all to the bottom of the hour because I want to have a conversation here with Trish Cook. Trish is past president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. And she joins us right now. Trish, it's great to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good morning. Thank you, Chip, for having me on the show today.
You bet. How's things over in Buchanan County?
Well, I'm actually still in D.C., but okay. So I'm guessing there's a lot of activity going on in Buchanan County, given that I talked to my husband and things are getting rolling. So,
Yeah, boy, up here, it is not only is it that time on the calendar, it's that time out in the field right now, too, isn't it? Things are looking pretty fit.
Yeah, definitely. It's exciting.
Yeah, it certainly is. Okay, so did you get to attend that joint session of Congress yesterday?
I did. I had the opportunity. Senator Ernst reached out to Iowa Pork and wanted to invite our president, Matt Gent, to that event, but he was already out of country supporting another Iowa Pork effort with our Canadian friends. So I was already in D.C., so I did get to go attend the joint session of Congress. It was quite an opportunity.
Well, tell us about that. How was that experience?
So, yeah, I went to Senator Ernst's office in the Russell Building, and we went over together with one of her staff members. She, of course, went to the floor, and she was one of the folks who was able to help escort the prime minister in. And I went up to the gallery with many other folks who were just had the opportunity to see and hear the prime minister. And it was very interesting, just as a reminder to your listeners, that pork is really important in the Japanese diet. So Iowa is the number one pork state, of course. And then the U.S. imports over $1 billion of pork to Japan. And the prime minister actually spent 3 years of his childhood in the U.S. He went to elementary school in Queens for 3 years. So his English is really, really good. And he had a really good sense of humor. He said that he kind of misses as a child watching the Flintstones. And he said, there's no translation for Yabba Dabba Doo. So.
Yeah. Really Yabba Dabba Doo in Japanese is Yabba Dabba Doo. I love it. Now that relationship, and that's part of the reason that Senator Ernst wanted you to be there, is the relationship between Iowa pork and Japan. You mentioned it's a $1 billion business. Did you get it? Was there an opportunity to do a little promotion while you were there?
I really just got to go, had the honor to be an attendee. I did not have any opportunity to promote, directly to anyone from the Japanese delegation. I do believe some other elected officials from Iowa were going to have some opportunities, but I just appreciated the chance to hear him speak. And just, there's a lot of good people watching up in the gallery when there's a joint session of Congress happening.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So Senator Ernst is working on some hog and pork related legislation as well. Let's get some updates on that. Start with the expanding agriculture export market. Exports Act, Trish, because when we look at the amount of money that is being spent on market research, market development here in the United States compared to other countries around the world, we're falling behind. We need to get some funding in place to develop some markets, correct?
That's correct. There has been in the past farm bill, and what she's asking for this year, this time, is to double it. Its efforts through the USDA Foreign Ag Service Program for money for market access programs and foreign market development. So it's been shown that every dollar spent in this area yields $24 in exports and gains. So if we could all do that on our farm, spend a dollar and get 24, we would do that without even thinking. So it's for agricultural products. So it's not just pork specific, but agricultural products. So those are dollars that our USDA, like I say, their Foreign Ag Service, is able to utilize to help with our markets.
Gotcha. Another item, and it's part of the reason that I think we'd all like to see the Farm Bill make some more progress than what it is making, especially on the Senate side of things, Trish. But it's hoped that the Farm Bill will be able to carry a piece of legislation to override, offset, correct California's Prop 12. Part of that would be Senator Ernst and others' EATS Act. What's the outlook on that?
Yeah, Senator Ernst and Senator Grassley and all four of our House members in Iowa have all been really supportive of the EATS Act, which is ending agricultural trade suppression. But basically, it's a push for a legislative fix to fix Prop 12, right, which restricts interstate commerce. So on the House side, I think there's a lot of positive vibes going on. Chairman G.T. Thompson is committed to getting it in the House version of the Farm Bill because he just understands how much chaos. To quote our Secretary of Ag, Tom Vilsack, he said this is going to create chaos in our marketplace if every state is going to make their own rules. And then how do you even know what's what and how to keep it straight? And it could be just totally chaos. So that is what's going on the House side. The Senate, what I hear, and you know, I'm just an Iowan there listening, is that I believe the Senate is kind of going to wait to see what the House comes up with a farm bill, and then they're going to do their own thoughts of it. And I know it's going to be a bigger struggle in the Senate just because of how, you know, the parties are, the democratically controlled Senate. We're having a hard time finding a Democrat who feels the same way we do about Prop 12 and the restriction of trade. There's some crazy talk about them wanting, or just folks like, well, let's just get some grant money available so people can modify their farms to Prop 12, which is so crazy because to put just verbiage in the farm bill is essentially no costs, no grants, no nothing. Right. Just make it so. And I always say in the U.S., what's wonderful about a free market economy is that if somebody demands a product, someone will supply a product, and it shouldn't have to be a law. They will come together in equilibrium to figure out what that price is and how what the quantities will be.
It's a great point. It's a great point, Trish. Some farrowing facilities have made the conversion over, but the lack of economic incentive is causing some real disruptions in the California pork market for consumers there. And consumers are finding out exactly what they voted for in many cases, aren't they?
They are. I had the opportunity to go. Iowa Farm Bureau sponsored about 20 Iowa pig farmers about in mid-March to go to California and just see how it's going there. What's the effect? We went to a grocery store and I picked up a package of Hormel Black Label bacon, a 1-pound package. At that grocery store was $10.98. I went to my hometown in Independence, Iowa, and looked at it. It was $4.98. So on that exact same package of bacon, $11 versus $5. And I know the USDA has come out and said it's about a 20% cost increase. And of course, you know, cut to cut and brand to brand, you'll see different things. But it's really not fair to the consumer there to ask them to pay that much more for something. And again, at the store that day, the butcher said, people ask, why is pork more expensive? And they don't even remember Prop 12 or what it's even about.
Yeah. Yeah, they were duped into voting for it. And now you see the push by the animal rights activists that are out there saying, listen, we need to shore up our efforts against proposed legislation like the EATS Act to keep these, you know, the rules and regs on farrowing in place. So it's just proof. It's proof that it's got nothing to do with the welfare of the animal. It's got everything to do with ending animal agriculture, right?
That's 100% accurate. The animal activist groups spent about $100 million on that ballot initiative in California to get it through. And it's all about the eradication of animal agriculture. It's all about a meat-free society. So if you look through the smoke and mirrors, that's what it boils down to.
Yep. That is exactly right. Going to switch gears on you here real quick. Biosecurity, animal health issues. It's always a top priority for the pork industry. But boy, it's kind of bubbling up to the surface again with the presence of the H5N1 in some dairies across the country. It's time to double down on biosecurity for hog producers, isn't it?
Yeah, there's never a time to take a break from biosecurity because you're only as strong as your weakest biosecurity measure. And so, again, as we're here this week, farmers are storming the hill, as they say, pig farmers talking to our members about what we want in the farm bill. And a big part of that is about foreign animal disease funding for the National Animal Health Lab Network, the National Disease Preparedness and Response Program, the National Vet Stockpile. So those things that just to have us be as ready as we can in the event of foreign animal disease, such as African swine fever, comes to the U.S.
Yeah. Yep. We do everything that we can to prevent that from happening. Tough times for hog producers right now. Margins are improving, especially for the summer months here, Trish. Brighter times ahead?
I sure hope so. We've had 18 months of record losses. And so we're every day is a fresh start, and we always just hope for optimism in our industry.
Love that. Every day is a fresh start, especially when there's bacon on the plate, right?
That's right. That's right. Makes it better.
Love it, Trish. You're a real asset. Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Thanks, Chip. I appreciate it.
All right. That's Trish Cook, past president of the Iowa Pork Producers Association. We're going to get the free-for-all going. Jim Wiesmeyer, Tyne Morgan, coming up next here on AgriTalk.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Joining us now, Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beej, we're trading off the highs, but we've still got some gains in the grain markets. What's going on?
Yeah, we hit a patch of short covering here about an hour or so ago. You know, probably not too surprising. I guess the funds are pretty heavily short across the grain and soy markets. And you know, just a very muted and negative reaction to yesterday's report data. So it's not that's triggering this by any means. It's broader based because when we look across the outside markets, crude oil is more than $2 higher. Gold is surging. Silver is surging. The commodity index as a whole is up sharply, and that's really fueling the short covering interest in the grain and soy markets this morning. Of note, it's happening in the face of strong gains in the U.S. dollar, which is up more than 700 points here.
Yeah. It's a pretty amazing day that we've got going in here. Just looking across all the commodities, it has not translated into strength in the livestock trade, though.
No, not at all. You know, we're facing fairly heavy pressure across the complex with live cattle, feeder cattle, and hogs all under pressure. So probably the one thing of note here is that April lean hog futures expire today, so they'll go off at noon Central Time, and then the May contract takes over as the lead month, and you know, big premiums in those deferred contracts to the cash index. Now, the cash index continues to rise seasonally, but traders are taking this opportunity to bank some profits, and we've seen a pullback after the recent string of contract highs. On the cattle side of things, you know, they're leaning on some support, so it's pretty critical how they finish up today.
Have a great weekend, Brian. Thank you, buddy. That is Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
From powering irrigation engines to warming buildings, propane has always been a part of American farm life. Now, you can be a part of propane's future and save money at the same time. The Propane Farm Incentive Program is a research initiative that provides farmers up to $5,000 towards the purchase of new propane-powered equipment. In exchange, participants share performance data to make tomorrow's ag operations more cost-effective, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly with propane. Getting started is simple. Visit propane.com/farm incentive to see if you're eligible.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. You're listening to AgriTalk, where the conversation begins. Join us at 855-4-TALK-AG.
Let's get this free-for-all going. Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm Chip. Let's bring back U.S. Farm Report host Tyne Morgan. Tyne.
Hello, Chip.
All right. And Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer. How you doing, buddy?
Pretty good. Always good to have Tyne on. She's my favorite radio person other than you, Chip.
Boy, you were you were walking a fine line right there, mister.
I covered.
Jim's check is in the mail, Chip. So, yeah. And if you don't pay him, I do.
yeah. No, we definitely, there is a cost involved with having Wiesmeyer on. There's no question about that.
Is it cost or liability? Which
I
one?
I said, well, I'm not going to explain that any further. It's just that there it is. I want to start with the number one issue that we've been talking about for a couple of weeks. And we're still trying to figure out exactly just how serious this might be with the issues that it might create for markets. But the H5N1 presence in some dairy herds. Tyne, you had more details on it this morning. We're up to 24 herds. We add South Dakota to the list of states. And we still can't get agreement on exactly what this virus should be called in the dairy herds. Tyne, explain.
Yeah. So from the way we understand it, the American Association of Bovine Practitioners, they were tasked with coming up with a new name for this virus. Chip, the reason being this virus has mutated so much, they felt like the strain of highly pathogenic avian influenza, what they were calling it, that it no longer fit. They needed to come up with a name for this strain that's impacting dairy cattle. And so they did just that. In fact, Sunday night, we received a release from AABP saying that the new name was going to be bovine influenza A virus. Okay. So we got this news Monday morning. Jim reported it as well. I know you've talked about it. And yep. Chip, I immediately reached out to APHIS that day and said, I just want to confirm that APHIS is adopting this name and that this is what the industry is going to call it, because that's what the release made it sound like was going to happen.
Right.
APHIS still won't answer. They still will not give us a yes or a no. You know, I've followed up a couple times. And so what it tells me is there is not an agreement on what we're going to call this. But the thing is, they talk about how it's mutating so much that that's why they had to come up with a new name. And, you know, I know Jim has talked about it. The more you test, the more cases we're going to confirm. So this is just the start. We're going, you know, we had two cases in New Mexico, another case in Texas. I mean, that's going to grow. But what find interesting, Jim, is the fact of how many days it is taking to get these results confirmed. So the way I understand it is once a vet sends in a sample, okay, they send it to a state lab. And the way I understand it is these state labs are not allowed to call it a positive. They have to call it a non-negative. And then they send it on to the national lab, and the national lab is the only one that can confirm that it is a positive case. So they can't even say positive. They have to say non-negative, send it all up the chain. And the way I understand it, Jim, is it takes about 5 days for that process to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this is why it takes APHIS so long to update their site online of the numbers that are in the press before it's reflected in the APHIS update of these cases.
Yes. Yeah, state agencies are way out in front of the USDA's head shop on these announcements. Yeah. That was the case in Idaho. That was the case in South Dakota this morning, Michigan. And the state people seem to be very, very much on top of this situation. Tyne, even though we've got some confusion over exactly what this is going to be called, I don't think we should lose track of the fact that this is being tracked very, very well. At least it seems to be, and that all the biosecurity measures that are needed are being taken.
Absolutely. But I mean, I will ask Chip, Jim, do you believe there are only 24 cases right now?
No.
Exactly. No. So, I mean, that's the thing is we really don't know. And you know, a lot of people keep comparing it to COVID, as in, you know, in the beginning it's slow, but as you test more, of course, you're going to get more confirmation. You know, and the good news is with dairy herds, What I'm hearing is it's still, once it's an infected herd, it impacts about 10% of the herd. Milk production drops for about 20%. And then after 21 days, it gets back to near normal. We're hearing of some culled animals, but it's not culled animals because they have to. I think it's just, you know, maybe some older cows anyway. And so they're going ahead and culling those animals because of cool prices right now, Chip. Yep. So I think you have to keep that in mind too. Yep. But for dairy, it is not having as big of an impact as it's having on these, on these flocks, on these poultry flocks. And we know that. But yeah, they have confirmed, we've talked about it. I know you've talked about it on AgriTalk. It is moving cow to cow. And so one theory, and we don't have any confirmation on this, but one theory is it is moving so rapidly via the milking equipment.
Yeah.
Because if you're only cleaning that, you know, before, you don't know that it's, you know, that you have a case, and you're only cleaning that milking equipment at the end of the day or twice a day or whatever that is. If you're moving that milk equipment from cow to cow, then that's maybe how it's spreading. No confirmation of that. We're asking all of these questions.
Right.
And the other question we have is how much has this mutated and how different is it from that highly pathogenic avian influenza strain that we know took such a toll on the poultry flock. I mean, I'm hearing it's more contagious, but again, it's kind of hard to get confirmation on any of this right now, Chip.
And that's a key, because the mutation, if it gets wild out there, then it can spread. And I don't know which way it'll go, but you got to watch that mutation angle.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's going to change. There's no questions. I don't think there's any question about that. And we're just kind of trying to keep up with what the consequences of that might be as we go forward. And source, you know, they have got to pin down exactly how this virus is getting into these herds. Because they talk about, you know, wild birds being out on holding ponds, the manure holding ponds at these dairies. Well, the cows don't have access to that. How exactly would it be getting there? They've got to look at the feed. They've got to look at everything, trying to figure out exactly what the source of this virus into these dairy herds is. So,
whenever we get the funding for the House Farm Bill that's coming out by, sometime in May, they will include a chunk of change for biosecurity. So I think that'll be needed.
Okay.
Jim, right. Have you heard, I mean, when we think back to PEDV, okay, and when that first started, it was a private company that then helped come out with a vaccination for that. So are they allowing private companies to have access to this strain in order to create a vaccine? Because not only are we talking about how it's spreading, but also a solution here. And I'm hearing that they're not allowing these private companies to have access to it. Again, it's hard to get details from anyone, but it was the private companies that helped come up with that vaccine. And it seems like right now we need all hands on deck.
Yeah, well, I know in the case of the bird flu, the original bird flu, there are vaccines that are available once allowed. But that's a sensitive issue as well, because it gets you into the trade policy area. A number of countries would not import from us for whatever reason. So, and Vilsack has said in the past, if this continues, they'll require a vaccine. So I think we need a statement from him on this issue as well.
Yep. Speaking of Vilsack, we're going to change gears here, guys. He was on CNBC this morning talking about food inflation, and I don't think he made any news. He defended farmers' case, I thought, adequately. In the conversation and said, you know, corrected some statements about, you know, commodity prices being high and stuff like that. Some commodity prices are high. Grain prices are not. But food inflation is a real thing, and affordability in general, Jim, is a real thing.
And it's going to sticky around with us. And what they should have asked him, Chip, is a USDA report that came out this week that said military food insecurity is double the civilian rate, that just over 25% of our military personnel have experienced food insecurity. That's more than double the rate of the civilian population, that stands at 10% or a little over 10%. There's your equity issue, Mr. Secretary. Help our military.
How do we allow that to happen?
It's a shame. It's a shame. And now we have a USDA report. I want to see how they dance around this one.
Well, yeah, there you go. And the other one, when, you know, when I hear things about military veterans and so on, I always think about Iowa or U.S. Senator Joni Ernst from Iowa. She's very, you know, looking up for the rights of our veterans and military personnel is very high on her list. We got to go to her and
absolutely
and ask her, what in the world? How did this happen?
Yeah. Yeah. These are the issues that I think with USDA's too much focus. You got to always worry about some equity issues, but they have a mindset toward the equity issues. But here, I think they've taken their eyes off the ball, and it's a shame of this military food insecurity being the double civilian rate. So, you know, come on, USDA.
Yep, yep, no doubt. All right. Hey, we got to take a break. We are in the middle of the free-for-all with Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer and U.S. Farm Report host Tyne Morgan. We had USDA reports this week, and we lost some USDA reports this week. We'll find out some of the details there, talk about some of the potential consequences, and then the farm bill. What's the latest? What's the status update? Could we see some progress in the House, force some action in the Senate? We'll discuss that next here on AgriTalk.
From powering irrigation engines to warming buildings, propane has always been a part of American farm life. Now you can be a part of propane's future and save money at the same time. The Propane Farm Incentive Program is a research initiative that provides farmers up to $5,000 towards the purchase of new propane-powered equipment. In exchange, participants share performance data to make tomorrow's ag operations more cost-effective, more efficient, and more environmentally friendly with propane. Getting started is simple. Visit propane.com/farmincentive to see if you're eligible.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
On your favorite radio station or your preferred digital device, AgriTalk is live every weekday.
Welcome back to AgriTalk and the free-for-all. We've got Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer, U.S. Farm Report host Tyne Morgan. We're going to have to go speed round here. I don't want to leave out details, but we got to go speed round. USDA reports out yesterday, Jim. Everybody's attention going into it was on the South American crop estimates, Brazilian corn and soybeans, Argentine corn and soybeans. USDA trimmed 1 million ton from the Argentine corn crop, and that was it. What are your market people that you talk with on a regular basis? What did they have to say about that?
Well, they're lower on Argentina than USDA. So there's a split within, you know, USDA and the private industry, Chip. On corn, I think what carryover actually went lower, I think was a result of ethanol, right?
Well, 25 to ethanol, 25 to feed and residual. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
those were the two major things I heard that we still don't have the right parameters on South American production.
Well, Chip, that's what I'm hearing. That's what I'm hearing, too. The biggest from analysts, the trade is just they're scratching their heads over how are these estimates from CONAB and these other places.
Right.
So much lower than what USDA is. And they just made no adjustment at all. And so, you know, the lack of changes to South America was the biggest question mark out of yesterday's report.
Yeah. The spread from CONAB to USDA is abnormally wide at this time of the year. So either USDA knows something that is acreage, or USDA's off base and needs to pay closer attention to what people on the ground there in Brazil are seeing from CONAB. And, you know, it's even the U.S. Ag Attaché in Brazil has lower numbers than what USDA does in the balance sheet. So,
yeah.
So I'm...
Our USDA started from a higher base, Chip. Assumption.
Yeah, acreage.
acreage. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, and that I'm sure that's it. That's what it's got to be. It's what it's got to be.
Chip, in Jim's newsletter yesterday, he was talking about the new analysis from FarmDoc where Brazil's, you know, booming cropland could expand 45% or 70 million acres in the years ahead. You know, if you look at kind of converting some of the overgrazed and overgrown pasture land, especially in key agricultural areas like Mato Grosso. Chip, my question is, when you see how much they could expand in the coming years, how do we compete with Brazil? Yeah. On a global scale? And is the answer, we don't?
Well, I think we continue to compete, but it's going to be on some different levels. One of the things that kind of surprises me from time to time is when I'm talking with people from the United Soybean Board, and they talk about how proud producers of, you know, aquaculture, fish growers, for example, in Asia, how proud they are to put the label produced with sustainable U.S. soy on a package of fish coming from their farm. So that's one of the things that it's one of the reasons that I'm not willing to roll my eyes at all the sustainable talk and the climate smart farming issues, because producers in areas outside of the U.S. are turning it into a premium product.
Yeah, what you just said is rebranding. We need to rebrand.
Yes.
And we need to rebrand, and we need to, you know, between Brazil and then the issues with China. I mean, it's proof. We need to rebrand and like they continue to do, and domesticate our soybean market. I mean,
We also need a better trade policy. Look at this week, Chip. Brazil said they were going to maintain tariffs on U.S. ethanol imports despite complaints from the Biden administration. But one option that Brazil wants is to reduce tariffs in exchange for an increase in the domestic U.S. blending mandate on the RFS. They have us like patsies, you know, it's our trade policy.
Well, and it's just the general relations with China that's breaking down that trade policy with China, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. You saw Vilsack. I thought one of the big stories this week was the Bloomberg interview in which he linked some of the downturn in our exports to China as a result of retaliation on their part of what some of our states, Arkansas and other states, are doing relative to prohibiting Chinese purchases of farmland.
Yeah.
And add Iowa to that list this week, right?
Yes.
Iowa passed a law this week. It increases surveillance of the you know, transactions in ownership. Doesn't prevent any ownership. It puts caps on it, and monitoring is going to be prioritized on that going forward. Jim, Farm Bill update. What's the situation?
Well, we're going to get, based on all the reports, so we're finally going to get the chairman's mark language, if you will, sometime in May. And the House Ag Committee, G.T. Thompson, chairman, wants to have a markup by Memorial Day. The key issues, Chip, is the Democrats are all aflutter. They're disagreeing amongst themselves on some of the ways that the Republicans have come up to find, I guess, another $40 to $50 billion beyond the $1.51 trillion 10-year baseline. That's going to eventually be a problem, because I don't know whether a farm bill can get through the House floor, because we're finally starting to talk about our debt, which is growing $1 trillion every 100 days. And when you add $40 to $50 billion additional dollars to the farm bill, some true conservative Republicans are going to say, wait a minute.
Yeah, that's right,
Chip.
And go ahead, Tyne.
It's also key to note that even if we see this in May, some had said maybe mid-April. Now, you know, Jim is saying May, and he has great sources on that. But the quickest that a farm bill has ever been passed, from the time it's introduced out of committee to the time the president signs it, is 9 months. That's the quickest it's ever happened. And you look at the environment in Washington right now. As Jim says, nothing quick happens in Washington. We are asking our ag economists in our monthly monitor, we are asking them for an update. When do you think we'll see a farm bill passed? and just in private conversations with some of these economists,
yep,
they think now after 2025.
Right, right, after 2025.
And
based on the response that we got from Senator Chuck Grassley on the show on Monday, he is not very optimistic about Senate making progress on the farm bill anytime soon.
Don't hold your breath.
Yep, no. That's right. You guys are great. Thank you so much. Pro Farmer Policy Analyst Jim Wiesmeyer, U.S. Farm Report host Tyne Morgan. Come back this afternoon. We're going to have a conversation with Chris Robinson, Robinson Ag Marketing, here on AgriTalk.